senseless strikes since October 7th. Humanitarian organizations report that more than 10 children on average lose one or both of their legs per day in the coastal territory. And that's just one aspect of the unending cycle of Israel's brutality against the people of Gaza. Apart from casualties, the regime's recurring attacks have caused indescribable devastation in the Palestinian territory. But when it comes to describing the true nature of the Israeli onslaught, there's no word better than genocide. There are multiple reports and countless evidence indicating that what's taking place in Gaza meets the definition of a genocidal war. Since the very beginning of the onslaught, millions of people around the world, along with a number of states, have been calling on international institutions to oblige Israel to end the genocide. South Africa is one of those states. The country, in late December, filed a lawsuit against Israel at the International Court of Justice. Now, nearly 1 month after the lawsuit was filed, the Hague-based court is set to convene on Friday to decide on South Africa's request for an interim ruling in its genocide case against Israel. The possible verdict by the ICJ would order Israel to announce a ceasefire in Gaza and allow more humanitarian aid into the Palestinian territory. In its filing, Pretoria referred to Israel's violation of the United Nations 1948 Genocide Convention. South Africa's application includes multiple offenses, from indiscriminate killing of Palestinians to the wholesale destruction of Gaza's infrastructure. Earlier in January, the Hague-based court convened two-day hearings. At the closing of the first day, the South African ambassador to the Netherlands asked the court to order Israel to immediately suspend its onslaught on the besieged strip.
One, the state of Israel shall immediately suspend its military operations in and against Gaza. Two, the state of Israel shall ensure that any military or irregular armed units which may be directed, supported, or influenced by it, as well as any organizations and persons which may be subject to its control, direction, or influence, take no steps in furtherance of the military operations referred to in point one above.
South Africa's move has been welcomed by Palestinian resistance movements. Hamas said the arguments and evidence put forth by South Africa proves Israel's crimes of genocide and ethnic cleansing in Gaza. The Palestinian Foreign Ministry also applauded the move, calling it a historic moment for humanity.
This is a historical moment for the Palestinian people and for humanity, as well as for the world order based on law.
A number of countries and international organizations have welcomed South Africa's case at the ICJ. The Organization of Islamic Countries, OIC, and the Arab League expressed their support for the case. Malaysia, Turkey, Jordan, and Iran are among the states voicing support for the motion. Israel's crimes against Palestinians in Gaza have also been referred to the International Criminal Court. Mexico and Chile have requested the ICC to probe the crimes against civilians in Gaza. Submitting lawsuits at international courts are parts of global efforts to mandate Israel to put an end to its non-stop strikes on Gaza, as their scale and nature dovetail with the widely accepted narrative that the onslaught is actually a genocidal war.
After the recent successful Yemeni army operation targeting the American military ship Ocean Jazz in the Gulf of Aden, the US and UK conducted a new series of air strikes targeting eight positions in the capital Sana'a. Despite the Yemeni attack on the US ship, the US military denies it, asserting continuous communication with the Ocean Jazz throughout its journey.
The naval forces of the Yemeni army carried out a military operation targeting an American military cargo ship Ocean Jazz in the Gulf of Aden using appropriate naval missiles. The Yemeni armed forces affirmed that retaliation against American and British attacks is inevitable and any new aggression will not go unpunished.
Military experts believe that the fresh air strikes against Yemen contradict US claims that the Yemeni attack is false.
When the U.S. denies our attack on the ship and then launches strikes against us, this is an act of revenge, and the U.S. is trying to prove that it's stronger. The American denial confirms that the strike was successful and that the Yemeni armed forces succeeded in targeting the American ship. The U.S. always denies being attacked to maintain its prestige before other countries.
According to the UK Ministry of Defence, US fighter jets from the carrier USS Eisenhower participated in Monday's strikes for RAF Typhoon, supported by a pair of Voyager tankers, joined the US forces. Yemen's Ansarullah officials state that American-British aggression is not new and has persisted since 2015, vowing retaliation against any Western attacks.
New strikes by American and British forces were launched, while the Yemeni armed forces have warned against new aggression against the Arab country. Yemeni people as well as political analysts suggest that continuous Western attacks will not deter Yemen's naval operations against Israeli-linked vessels in the Red Sea. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
From long-range missile attacks on Israel, to hitting U.S. military bases in Iraq and Syria with drones and rockets. The Islamic resistance in Iraq has been increasing its operations ever since October 7 as a response to the genocide in Gaza.
The axis of resistance believes in unity. Thus, the struggle in Gaza necessarily means the struggle within the axis of resistance as a whole. Today, we witness an escalation in the region responding to Israel and its backers, who hold fully responsible for the crimes committed against Palestinians.
The Pentagon says more than 140 attacks were carried out against U.S. military bases in Iraq and Syria since October 7, leaving more than 70 personnel injured. The heaviest of these attacks took place on Saturday on the U.S. Ain al-Assad Air Base in western Baghdad. The Iraqi resistance claimed responsibility for the attack.
Following the onslaught on Gaza, the resistance went back to conducting operations against foreign forces. It is clear that these forces have shown their objectives in the country, targeting Iraqi anti-terror forces multiple times.
Amid the growing military tension in the region, Iraq's Prime Minister Mohammed Shia al-Sudani renewed his call to end the U.S. military presence in Iraq. During the World Economic Forum in Davos, he said the end of international coalition mission is a necessity for the security and stability of Iraq. He added that the coalition forces are no longer needed in the country. Al-Sudani called for talks to reach a timetable regarding the withdrawal of U.S. forces as soon as possible.
According to the first article in Iraq's constitution, which puts the country as an independent and fully sovereign state, we, the Iraqi parliament, have gathered to enact a law which binds the government to end the presence of foreign forces in the country.
Both the Iraqi government and nation have made it clear that the U.S. forces are not welcome in their country, with proof that these forces cause instability in Iraq. Amid calls to end the U.S. military presence in the country, and as the escalations continues in the region, the resistance in Iraq asserted that it will carry on with its operations against U.S. military bases in Iraq and Syria until the Israeli genocide war on Gaza Strip stops. Muslim Salim, Baghdad.
An unusual fervor has gripped parts of India as Prime Minister Narendra Modi unveiled a grand Hindu temple in the town of Ayodhya in northern state of Uttar Pradesh. This was one of the main election pledges of the ruling Bharatiya Janata Party after a decade-long movement to build the temple on the site of a raised mosque. Hindus believe the site was the birthplace of their god Rama, but for Vakil, who hails from Ayodhya, the temple is a sign of death, destruction and misery. He says many left their homes weeks ago fearing violence.
The temple has fulfilled a decade-long pledge of the ruling BJP to build this largest Hindu temple in the city of Ayodhya, which was once a flashpoint of deadly communal clashes between Muslims and Hindus. Many Muslims, however, say this day refreshes the memories of the violent past when the members of the family were lost forever due to riots.
For unemployed graduate Nikhil, who drives an auto rickshaw to make ends meet, it's a usual day. He says politicians have mostly used religion as a political tool to garner votes.
It's nothing more than politics, and many people don't care about such things anymore. We have unemployment crisis in the country, and this is only distracting people from actual issues the country is facing.
Most of the Muslims accepted the court decision, but it would have been better if they constructed the temple and the mosque at the same time, which they allotted the land for. The temple is ready, but mosque is nowhere.
While unveiling the temple, Prime Minister Modi said their God has returned after years of patience and sacrifice amid huge chants hailing the Hindu god Ram. The event was showcased as one of the most historic moments of national importance in the Hindu-majority India.
Our Lord Ram has finally arrived in Ayodhya. I congratulate my people on this day, and I am sure that my fellow citizens are happy. I feel blessed to be part of this ceremony. And 22nd January is the beginning of a new era. This is a festival for us.
On December 1992, a huge mob of Hindu right-wing activists demolished the mosque, sparking religious riots that killed nearly 2,000 people, mostly Muslims. Hindus and Muslims have contested the ownership of the site, even taking it to court. However, the site was allotted to the temple. The opening ceremony was telecast live across the country, with politicians, billionaires, and Bollywood stars attending. The government declared a half-day holiday on Monday. The temple is set to boost the chance of Modi retaining office for a third consecutive period in May this year as the country gears up for general elections. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Kuwait, a key player in the global oil market, has recently experienced a significant setback in its petrol exports to Europe, with a staggering 43% decline, according to a recent S&P report. This decrease is mainly caused by escalating pressure on ship owners to steer clear of the Red Sea, which has seen an exchange of fire between American and Yemeni forces in recent days. The situation escalated after the US-UK alliance airstrikes on Yemen earlier this month. The two countries claim they acted to protect international shipping from Yemeni attacks. This is while attacks by Yemenis are only aimed at Israeli vessels or vessels moving toward the Israeli-occupied territories. They say this is a targeted effort to apply pressure on Israel to move towards an urgent ceasefire in Gaza.
The attack of Yemeni fighters on Israeli ships is a natural reaction to pressure countries that support Israel to stop their support, while also demanding a ceasefire in Gaza. If the attack on Yemen continues, the resistance will continue to respond, and this could get bigger.
This situation has especially hurt Europe, significantly impacting its imports of refined petroleum products in the first half of January. European supply chains are already strained, experiencing delays, increased shipping costs, and potential financial losses for businesses dependent on the Red Sea route. It appears that Europe's steadfast support for Israel has had severe repercussions for the continent itself.
The Yemeni fighters target only Israeli vessels and those which are going to Israel. The alternative is taking another route from Ras Raja Saleh. This transfer takes 15 days or more with higher costs. These factors in the short run will cause inflation. Economists warn of a domino effect that could eventually hit European consumers harder than the inflation of 2022 during the Russia-Ukraine conflict. They warn Europe may face higher energy costs and delayed shipments, leading to an economic crisis.
Europe finds itself in a precarious position as it appears to be embarking on a military involvement in the situation in the region, risking its vested interests in the Persian Gulf region and its trade connections. In the meantime, the Yemeni resistance fighters are being widely hailed across Muslim countries for adopting effective strategies to pressure Israel to agree to a ceasefire in Gaza.
As the world continues to monitor these developments in the Red Sea, the Yemeni resistance fighters continue to fight to pressure Israel for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. This is Farah Al-Hashim, Kuwait City.
The world's largest humanitarian network mobilized to alleviate the suffering of the people of Gaza under incessant Israeli attacks. Iran's Red Crescent Society, the International Committee of the Red Cross, the International Federation of the Red Cross and the Red Crescent Societies, and a number of other international organizations are now joining hands to provide assistance and deliver aid shipments to Gaza, a process that has been hindered over the past 3 months due to the Zionist regime's total disrespect for any kind of international law, including the Geneva Conventions.
The main obstacle we are facing right now for the aid in Gaza is the lack of respect of international humanitarian law, the law that is the law during war. And this law has to be respected by all the parties in this conflict, and this we do not see on the ground. Secondly, we need, of course, access. We need better and more reliable, sustained access into Gaza and within Gaza, in order, that's the third point, to increase and scale up humanitarian assistance to the Strip. Right now, it's by far not sufficient what can go into the Strip for this population that is in desperate need of all the items. We need more crossing point, we need regular supply lines, and we need a procedure that allows humanitarian assistance at scale.
Over 24 delegates representing regional divisions of relief organizations operating in conflict zones such as Doctors Without Borders and UNICEF, as well as the ICRC and IRCS, took part in the conference, hoping to find practical measures to help the people of Gaza.
The most important thing is the humanitarian diplomacy, because nothing in the world is more effective than people sitting down and discussing and talking and to come to solutions in which the affected people can find assistance.
In this such a conference, parallel to what we see all around the world, the demonstrations of millions of the people who are arising. We have not seen throughout the history that 300,000, 400,000 people come in London and support the Palestinians, more than a million people in the United States. So what we believe that if we held such a conferences in different countries, which is the first one in Iran, we can put some sorts of pressures on the governments that they also make a move to try to solve an end to this catastrophe which is happening in Gaza.
So far, a substantial amount of humanitarian aid, including medicine, food, and tents weighing 10,000 tons, has been provided by Iran and is ready to be dispatched to Gaza. Setting up an international fund and also establishing routes into Gaza to assist the civilians in need are among the most important decisions made during this conference. Gizem Shahmari, Tehran.
A solemn funeral procession has been held at the Sayyida Ruqayya Shrine in the heart of the Syrian capital, Damascus. The procession was held for the five Iranian military advisors who were martyred in an Israeli attack on the residential neighborhood of Mazze. Many people attended the funeral, including religious figures and pilgrims from various countries who affirmed that martyrdom paves the way to victory over the enemies.
Tariq al-Shahada.
The path of martyrdom will culminate in victory, despite the enemy's will. We will emerge triumphant, forcing the enemy out of our land. Operation Al-Aqsa Flood will sweep the enemy away. Through solidarity in the resistance front, from Islamic Iran to Hezbollah in Lebanon, the popular mobilization forces in Iraq, and the heroic Houthis in Yemen, along with our Palestinian people and the Palestinian resistance.
We came to visit the shrine of Sayyida Ruqayya and attended the funeral of Iranian and Syrian martyrs. We are all united as Wenixes from southern Lebanon to Iran, Iraq, and Syria, and we will not fear or weaken, no matter the sacrifices.
With great pride, honor, and faith in martyrdom, the funeral procession arrived at the Sayyida Zainab Shrine, peace be upon her, for prayers over the martyrs' bodies. Participants emphasized that the enemy's atrocities cannot intimidate them or deter them from continuing on the path of resistance until victory is achieved with the blessing of the martyrs' blood. Iran's Charged Affairs affirmed that there will be a response to the Israeli crime.
Once again, the Zionist entity, through its aggression, violates Syrian sovereignty and targets a building housing Iranian advisors in Damascus. Today, as we participate in the funeral ceremonies of these great martyrs, we affirm to the Zionist entity that this crime will not go unpunished, as the Islamic Republic of Iran has reiterated, we will not forget our martyrs, and the Zionist entity will face retaliation from the axis of resistance.
These are sacrifices made by the heroes of the popular mobilization forces in Iraq, as well as the resistance in Syria and Iran. These are martyrs who give their lives for the resistance front. This is the path of our martyrs and Imam Hussein, peace be upon him. This aggression exposes the enemy's setbacks in Syria and in Gaza, which has driven them to commit these crimes.
The mourners carried the coffins of the martyrs with a mix of sadness and anger, chanting slogans demanding revenge and punishment. They affirmed their readiness to go all the way on the path of liberating Al-Quds and all occupied territories, no matter how great the sacrifices may be. They expressed confidence in the capabilities of the Axis of Resistance and the wisdom of its leadership. Once again, Syrian and Iranian blood mixed to water the land of Damascus as a result of an Israeli criminal attack. And once again, we see Syrians and Iranians united more than ever and determined to defeat the Zionist regime. Ibrahim Wahdi, Damascus.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Germany probably ended 2023 with its first recession since the coronavirus pandemic, as analysts reckon data will reveal a second straight contraction in output in the fourth quarter of 2023. We have taken a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Bloomberg News Agency has covered this story and tells us more. German industrial output unexpectedly declined in November, underscoring the persistent manufacturing woes in Europe's largest economy. The Statistics Office of Germany said on Tuesday, 9th of January, production declined 0.7% from October, led by capital goods and intermediate goods. That's the sixth consecutive drop and defies economists in a Bloomberg survey who'd predicted a 0.3% increase. Germany probably ended 2023 with its first recession since the coronavirus pandemic, as analysts reckon data will reveal a second straight contraction in output in the fourth quarter of 2023. Manufacturers, Germany's economic backbone, are struggling from costly energy, higher global interest rates, and a slowdown in the Chinese economy. Bloomberg economists said disappointing November production data and the recent business expectations deterioration point to a bumpy start to the year for industry in Germany. We maintain our baseline view for a slight gross domestic product increase in the first quarter of 2024, driven by a higher dynamic in the service sector. There is substantial risk, however, that a more pronounced industry weakness will drag the economy down again in the first quarter of 2024. The figures come just a day after a reading for factory orders also fell short of expectations, Additionally, with the German government straitjacketed over ramping up investment and train strikes looming recently, few economists anticipate much of a pickup this year. German railway operator Deutsche Bahn AG's attempt to halt strikes by a court injunction was rejected by Frankfurt's Labour Court on Monday, 8th of January. Speaking to Bloomberg Television after Tuesday data was released, Holger Schmieding, chief economist at Berenberg, claimed Germany is experiencing cyclical rather than structural issues and will bounce back as the manufacturing sector returns to significant growth in the second half of 2024. He said Germany was in recession last year, yes, but the indicators are starting to stabilize. We are bottoming out in the German economy. Meanwhile, citing the country's federal network agency, the German magazine Der Spiegel writes, households in Germany will continue to struggle with high electricity and heating costs amid the cost of living crisis. The warning comes despite the recent fall in household energy prices, which have decreased 4.5% this year compared to November of last year. The head of the federal network agency, Klaus Müller, was quoted as saying in an interview with the Rheinische Post, "The era of cheap energy is over, at least as long as we continue to consume large quantities of conventionally generated energy." Klaus Müller added, "Although wholesale electricity prices have fallen significantly compared to 2022, the price level is still higher than before the start of the Ukraine conflict," adding that nothing will change in the near future. The energy regulator noted that an average four-person household will pay €120 more in network fees per year due to the government's decision to eliminate the previously planned €5.5 billion subsidy. Müller assumed network operators will pass the price rise on to German customers, predicting sooner or later the cost will reach all consumers regardless of when the changes are implemented. Germany's transmission system operators reportedly announced in mid-December that the grid fees will rise from 3.12 cents per kilowatt hour in 2023 to 6.43 cents next year. Germany, which relied on Russia for 40% of its natural gas demand before 2022, was among the hardest hit by the reduction of Russian energy supplies to Europe last year. Deliveries were either significantly curtailed or entirely halted after the European Union imposed sanctions on Moscow in response to the Ukraine conflict, and the Nord Stream pipelines delivered Russian gas to Germany mysteriously blew up. The Reuters news agency has also covered this story and tells us more. German farmers started a week of nationwide protests early on Monday, 8th of January, in response to plans to phase out agricultural subsidies as the coalition government scrambles to fix its finances. Images showed convoys of tractors and trucks, some adorned with protest banners, on German roads in sub-zero pre-dawn temperatures. German police reports said that roads and highway ramps were blocked in multiple locations, causing traffic jams during the morning rush hour. Farmers have vowed to blockade major traffic and logistics routes throughout next week, on Monday, 15th of January, as they warn that an end to tax breaks will drive farms out of business. The head of German Farmers Association, DBV, asked the public for sympathy in an interview published on Monday, 8th of January. He told the Stern magazine, "We do not want to lose the support and solidarity we have received from large parts of the German population." But he said the farmers will not accept the planned tax hikes for the agricultural sector. Recent backlash from farmers prompted the German Chancellor Olaf Scholz's coalition, racing to finalise a 2024 budget draft that was delayed by a court ruling, to make unexpected changes, including modifying plans to cut subsidies for agriculture. Rather than abruptly ending the farmers' tax breaks on agricultural diesel, the subsidy will be reduced by 40% this year, by 30% next year, and will end entirely in 2026. The government also dropped plans to abolish the preferential treatment in vehicle tax for forestry and agriculture. However, the DBV said the changes were not enough and stuck with plans for protests in the coming days. Russia's Sputnik news agency has also covered the same story. According to an opinion poll by YouGov, at least 74% of the German public disapprove of Chancellor Olaf Scholz's performance, making it the highest level of dissatisfaction on record for a sitting German chancellor. At least 77% of the German public also said they place little to no trust in the way Olaf Scholz governs the country. And according to a separate opinion poll by Infotest Dimap, if elections were held today, Olaf Scholz's Social Democratic Party, the SPD, would receive just 14% of the vote, which is 2% less than last month's figure and the lowest since June of 2021. A whopping 73% of the public also said they were unhappy with the traffic light coalition government, making it the worst monthly figure since the coalition first came to power. The opinion poll comes when Germany's economy has been particularly struggling ever since the government failed to repurpose 60 billion euros left over from the COVID-19 pandemic.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The ICJ International Court of Justice will decide whether to order emergency measures relating to the U.S.-Israeli genocidal war in Gaza. Although the court will not deal with the main question of whether Israel is committing genocide or not, it will look at possible emergency measures requested by South Africa to restrain Israel's actions. But will it do that even if it announces that Israeli actions do constitute that a genocide is taking place? We're going to ask those questions from our guests as to whether the U.S. will continue backing Israel also in this genocidal war, which Israel is losing on the ground. But first, let's take a look at this report on what the subject of our Spotlight program is. Our guest joining us, George Samiali, is a senior research fellow at the Global Policy Institute from London. Also, Eve Zangler, author and political activist, who joins us from Montreal. Okay, I jumped the gun a little too quickly. Before engaging with our guests, let's take a look at this comprehensive report.
This is Gaza, where Israel's air and artillery strikes have become a regular occurrence. In the besieged strip, sounds of bombardment are followed by screams of mothers losing their kids, as well as cries of children whose parents are killed by the regime. Tens of thousands of Palestinians, most of them women and kids, have been killed in the relentless strikes since October 7th. Humanitarian organizations report that more than 10 children on average lose one or both of their legs per day in the coastal territory. And that's just one aspect of the unending cycle of Israel's brutality against the people of Gaza. Apart from casualties, the regime's recurring attacks have caused indescribable devastation in the Palestinian territory. But when it comes to describing the true nature of the Israeli onslaught, there's no word better than genocide. There are multiple reports and countless evidence indicating that what's taking place in Gaza meets the definition of a genocidal war. Since the very beginning of the onslaught, millions of people around the world, along with a number of states, have been calling on international institutions to oblige Israel to end the genocide. South Africa is one of those states. The country, in late December, filed a lawsuit against Israel at the International Court of Justice. Now, nearly 1 month after the lawsuit was filed, the Hague-based court is set to convene on Friday to decide on South Africa's request for an interim ruling in its genocide case against Israel. The possible verdict by the ICJ would order Israel to announce a ceasefire in Gaza and allow more humanitarian aid into the Palestinian territory. In its filing, Pretoria referred to Israel's violation of the United Nations 1948 Genocide Convention. South Africa's application includes multiple offenses, from indiscriminate killing of Palestinians to the wholesale destruction of Gaza's infrastructure. Earlier in January, the Hague-based court convened two-day hearings. At the closing of the first day, the South African ambassador to the Netherlands asked the court to order Israel to immediately suspend its onslaught on the besieged strip.
One, the state of Israel shall immediately suspend its military operations in and against Gaza. Two, the state of Israel shall ensure that any military or irregular armed units which may be directed, supported, or influenced by it, as well as any organizations and persons which may be subject to its control, direction, or influence, take no steps in furtherance of the military operations referred to in point one above.
South Africa's move has been welcomed by Palestinian resistance movements. Hamas said the arguments and evidence put forth by South Africa proves Israel's crimes of genocide and ethnic cleansing in Gaza. The Palestinian Foreign Ministry also applauded the move, calling it a historic moment for humanity.
This is a historical moment for the Palestinian people and for humanity, as well as for the world order based on law.
A number of countries and international organizations have welcomed South Africa's case at the ICJ. The Organization of Islamic Countries, OIC, and the Arab League expressed their support for the case. Malaysia, Turkey, Jordan, and Iran are among the states voicing support for the motion. Israel's crimes against Palestinians in Gaza have also been referred to the International Criminal Court. Mexico and Chile have requested the ICC to probe the crimes against civilians in Gaza. Submitting lawsuits at international courts are parts of global efforts to mandate Israel to put an end to its non-stop strikes on Gaza, as their scale and nature dovetail with the widely accepted narrative that the onslaught is actually a genocidal war.
Okay, let me start with you, George Samueli. We just heard that report, and a quick question. Tell us what the ICJ court is going to decide on and make an announcement on, perhaps.
That they probably will ask for some provisional measures that Israel should take, but they will be much less than South Africa had asked for. I think they probably will ask for a much greater access to humanitarian assistance. I think they will ask for a great deal more restraint on the part of Israeli politicians, Israeli leaders, as to what they say. In other words, to cut back on any kind of incendiary comments that sound like a call for genocide. And that means they may even ask that those who have made these incendiary comments should be punished. I don't think they're going to ask Israel to cease all military operations. I just don't think the votes are there. I mean, the 17 judges, if you consider how they are likely to vote, you think about what countries they come from, the judges that come from NATO countries, I think almost certainly will not vote to ask Israel to restrain, to cut off its military operations. And I think even some of the countries that are not in NATO but are closely aligned with the United States, such as Japan, will also not ask Israel to cease military operations. So I think it'll be a very limited measures that the ICJ will ask for tomorrow.
If they don't do that, Yves Zangler, doesn't that give Israel a green light to continue with its operations? And why wouldn't they question Israel, whether Israel's committing genocide?
Well, why wouldn't they? Is the politics of it, as my colleague just stated, that there's a lot of pressure from the NATO countries, G7. Whether it gives a green light, I think that a decision that isn't pretty clearly saying that Israel needs to cease its violence, Israel will try to spin that as a green light. I don't think that's exactly, you know, correct, but that is how it will probably Israel try to spin it. But I think irrespective of that, obviously, you know, this provisional ruling that says they should cease their violence is what I'm hoping for, and I think probably what most of humanity is hoping for. I think just the process, certainly within Canada, where I'm speaking from, forcing into the popular discussion that there's people saying this is a genocide, and forcing the Israel lobby to react to that has been a positive exercise. Now I'm, you know, just hoping, fingers crossed, that it's better decision than the previous speaker stated, and it says that they should cease their violence.
Just by chance, what if the ICJ does find Israel to have committed genocide or make remarks to that effect, and maybe even go for asking us for a ceasefire against all odds of what you have said there, George Samieli? What would happen then?
Well, obviously, in that case, Israel would ignore such a decision, and Israel's allies, namely the United States and to a lesser extent the United Kingdom and Germany, would say this is a biased court, this is totally unfair, totally outrageous. Israel has to defend itself. Israel has to continually have at the front of its mind October the 7th, October the 7th, October the 7th. And so they'll just say, let's just ignore it. I mean, let's remember, the United States has in the past ignored ICJ rulings. I mean, in 1986, the ICJ ruled that the United States was waging an illegal war against Nicaragua, that it was sponsoring a terrorist group in Nicaragua, and it was unlawfully mining the ports of Nicaragua. And the United States just simply said, well, we don't care. I think Israel will probably do that. But of course, without question, if the ICJ does make such a ruling tomorrow, it'll be a very devastating public relations blow to Israel, because you're right. I mean, the Genocide Convention was created precisely in response to what had happened to the Jews in World War II. And so for Israel now to be essentially accused and found by the ICJ to be engaging in genocide, that's a serious blow to Israel.
And how would that stand if that was to be the case for the U.S., Yves Zangler?
It would put a lot of pressure on the U.S., there's no doubt. The U.S. is backing Israel's slaughter in so many different ways, through arms shipments, through diplomacy, intelligence, on and on and on. It would ramp up the pressure on the Biden administration, which is already under significant pressure internally within the left wing of the Democratic Party. Biden can't go and speak in public anymore without being heckled for his backing of Israel's genocide. So it would ramp up the pressure on the U.S. and it would ramp the pressure up on the Trudeau government to stop enabling. And I think probably also in the U.K. and other European countries, obviously they'll try to, you know, Germany, which has intervening on Israel's behalf on this, will try to dismiss it. But even those places where they try to dismiss it, like the U.S., it's going to ratchet up the pressure to and I think there's probably, it may even be some elements of the Israeli government that would find that the a ruling by the ICJ gives them some sort of out. Clearly, they're not going to succeed in destroying Hamas. And there's segments, it seems like, of the Israeli establishment that wants to figure out some way out of the disaster that they are causing for Israel's long-term power. So maybe the ICJ ruling, a good ICJ ruling, would even enable them to justify toning down their violence.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
When you take a look at a statement made by the former chief of staff of the Israeli regime forces, this is what he has said, George Samieli: whoever speaks of the absolute defeat of Hamas in Gaza and of it no longer having the will or the capability to harm Israel is not speaking the truth. Basically, you are having many who are saying that, and that has caused rifts within the Israeli cabinet and, of course, the general public at large. Do you think that that will prove to be a driving force to maybe have the Israeli regime stop what it can't achieve? Because then what purpose does it have executing this U.S.-Israeli genocidal war?
Well, there's no question, I mean, that there are very real divisions in Israel among the political leadership and the military leadership. They don't think this war is going particularly well. They don't see any prospect of victory, which means that Netanyahu is just continuing with this slaughter. Israel is obviously losing whatever support it has in the outside world, but also they're not really getting anywhere militarily, and there's no prospect of any improvement. However, I think that's separate from trying to comply with a ruling from the ICJ. I don't think anyone in Israel, you know, whatever disagreements they might have with Netanyahu, I don't think anyone in Israel will accept the principle that Israel should adhere to a ruling from an international court. Now, you know, the ICC, the Israel obviously doesn't recognize the jurisdiction of the ICC, so no one cares about that. But Israel does respect sort of the ICJ. It does at least accept the jurisdiction of the ICJ, even though it ignored the ICJ ruling on the wall that it built around the West Bank. So I don't think that they would just simply say, okay, well, the ICJ called on us to cease all military operations, that we're going to do what they tell us to do. I don't think that's going to happen. That's why I think it's much more likely that they'll be asked to do some limited things which Israel can accept, though they can accept it verbally. It doesn't mean they'll actually do it practically. They're not going to implement it practically, but at least say, okay, Shine, we'll do that. It's much more likely that they'll do something limited than to agree to something major, such as ceasing all military operations.
What do you make, Zengler, of the proposal that Israel made for a pause, as it called it, for the captives to be released in exchange for the prisoners that Israel is holding in phases, which also included Palestinians to return to Gaza City? This happened in the span of 24 hours, where there were roughly 24 regime forces who were also killed. Do you think Israel is realizing maybe the writing on the wall here?
Well, I think that was probably more of a play to the parents of those held in or the family members of those held in Gaza, and this was a way for Netanyahu to show that he's, you know, trying to get their release. I think it's maybe distinct from the realization that the military campaign is not going as well as they would hope. But I don't know. You know, I think that it's also the military campaign thing is you know, I don't believe that Netanyahu thought he was going to actually eliminate Hamas. I don't necessarily believe that he believed his, you know, initial rhetoric, because their objective is, you know, I think there is, they would like to eliminate Hamas if they could, but also they want to drive people out of Gaza. They want to make Gaza unlivable. So their own rhetoric of fighting till all Hamas is eliminated is of course partly sort of a justification for just, you know, killing and killing in Gaza and fighting for maybe throughout all of 2024, like some have stated. But so I think Israel's, you know, they're not succeeding militarily like they would have wanted to, but I don't know that they've been defeated either, in the sense that their aim is not solely to actually get Hamas, but is actually just to, you know, terrorize Palestinians in Gaza.
Well, this thing that Netanyahu has proposed, along with their other far-right ministers, George Samueli, is called voluntary migration. But it's quite interesting how they also use the word immigration in the mix of things. Isn't that against international law? And by some accounts, if I'm not incorrect, that it's a war crime to do that?
Absolutely, it's a war crime. I mean, it's essentially ethnic cleansing. I mean, making conditions for life so intolerable that people have no choice but to leave is undoubtedly a war crime. It's going to be quite hard to pull something like that off, because the United States, Israel's enabler, has kind of drawn a line in the sand, to the extent that the United States ever really draws a line in the sand for Israel. But publicly, it has said this is something they will not accept. And of course, Egypt and Jordan have said that they're not going to cooperate with any plan along those lines. But there are states that maybe, you know, if you could bribe them, give them enough money, they'll go along with Israel. I mean, there have been stories that there are states in Africa that will cooperate in something like this. I mean, if we're talking about an awful lot of people, and I don't know whether if one African country takes 10,000 and another takes another 10,000, we're still a long way from 2 million people. So I don't quite know how the math is going to work for this Israel plan. Undoubtedly, it's a horrific plan. And certainly, while the ICJ case is going to go on, because that's going to be an ongoing thing for several years, not a good idea for Israel to go down that path.
Yves Zengler, Iran weeks ago said that the ICC needs to treat the charges against the Israeli regime.